Thank you, Professor Han, for this wonderful introduction. I would like to thank Professor Lackner for inviting here to be here. And I also want to thank all the members of the IKKF family who have provided me this fantastic working environment where I get to work with all of my brilliant colleagues. So today I want to talk about Confucius. As you know, Confucius is a very famous historical figure. We all know lots of well-known facts about him. For example, he was a teacher, he was a moral philosopher. But there are also lots of well-known facts about him. For example, lots of people have the impression that he was short, skinny, and old. He somehow gives people this impression of being civil, but physically weak. But actually, Confucius was quite tall. He was not as tall as Yao Ming, but probably taller than Jeremy Lin. His father was also was a very famous warrior from the state of Wu. And the highest position Confucius took was a martial one. And there are also other narratives and images of Confucius that are so outlandish to the extent that we are no longer familiar with. For example, in the corpus of the text I'm going to talk about today, Confucius is compared to large animals, such as a dragon or an ox. And more interestingly, he's also compared to constellations, like the Big Dipper over here and the constellation Mao. Also in this corpus of text, Confucius has very strange facial features. For example, he has a dragon-like forehead, moon-like temples, sun-like nose, yellow river-like eyes, Big Dipper-like lips, and his face looks like the constellation flourishing literature, Wenchang. So if you put all these descriptions together, you will have an image of Confucius that looks something like this. As you can see, this is certainly different from later portrayal of Confucius. And more interestingly, this is also quite different from how people imagine Confucius from a time that was relatively contemporary to this corpus of text. For example, in a stone relief from the 2nd century CE China, we have Confucius over here, who doesn't really look so different from the other figures here. Of course, we don't really have that much pictorial detail over here. So what is this corpus of text? Scholars usually refer to them as apocrypha or apocryphal texts, Chen Wei. They appear in the beginning decades of the 1st century CE, and they contain information about astrology, anecdotes about ancient sage kings and Confucius. They also contain many prophecies. These prophecies mainly serve to legitimize the rule of the current newly revived dynasty, the Han Dynasty, and its imperial family, the Liu family. So in this corpus of text, Confucius is also depicted as somehow a prophet. And if you compare the image of Confucius being a prophet with the early image of Jesus Christ in the Gospels, you, as a prophet, you will find something odd. For Jesus, actually, we have a social context where we can find prophets traveling around before, during, and after Jesus' time. We also have images of great prophets such as Moses in the Jewish scripture and the other traditions. But this is not so much the case for Confucius. We don't really have that kind of social context where we can find prophets, or at least not that comparable to this image of Confucius in the apocryphal text. So that is to say that this image of Confucius is not only a little bit outlandish to us, but also somehow odd, or at least new, to people from the 1st century CE China. So today I want to talk about specifically this image of Confucius. Previously, scholars have touched on this issue, such as Gu Jiegang, Yasui Kozan, Lionel Jensen, and more recently, Xu Xingwu. But my approach will be different from them. Instead of just showing you this image of Confucius, I want to talk about why it was a good idea to depict Confucius in such outlandish way, and in what way the authors made the authors of apocryphal texts made such image so that they would think at least was plausible to the audience of apocryphal texts, namely the literati from the first century CE. Apocryphal texts have very bad reputation for being poorly written. Scholars consider them incoherent, self-contradictory, and full of anachronism. Modern scholars also consider them full of superstitiousness. I think part of the reason of such evaluation is that we have difficulties in relating this corpus of text to anything else. For example, in apocryphal texts, they talk about the ancient sage kings, they talk about Confucius and his disciples, they talk about the five Confucian classics. The titles of many apocryphal texts even contain the titles of the five classics, but the content is very different from any original Confucian teaching. So some scholars will argue that apocryphal texts are probably some mutant or contaminated form of early Confucianism, and apocryphal texts are influenced by certain traditions, such as the tradition some certain folk religions or some present forms of religious Taoism or a tradition called Master of Methods, Feng Shi. But the problem of this theory is that, first of all, we don't really have that much information about these traditions anyway. We don't even know whether they existed. And secondly, for the very little information we know, it's not that similar to apocryphal texts anyway. And more importantly, I suspect sometimes that people use these traditions as, I would call it, dumpster words, where scholars just attribute certain features to certain traditions so that they can avoid further explaining why these phenomena took place. For example, when they see this apocryphal Confucius, they will say that, Confucius is depicted in such weird way that is so different from the traditional portrayal because that's how the tradition of Master of Methods always did. So they avoid further explaining what's going on here. Today, I want to argue that we don't really need to go very far to relate apocryphal texts to some original Confucian teaching or to some obscure traditions that we are not even sure whether they existed. We can just look into the immediate social and intellectual context to make sense of this apocryphal Confucius. And as I will show you through the lecture, this apocryphal Confucius is mainly based on rearrangement and appropriation of existing knowledge and existing texts that were relatively familiar to the literati from the first century CE. And this image is also largely derived from concerns and assumptions of the communities of the literati during that time. The larger implication of this case study is that sometimes when we see a seemingly exotic feature in intellectual history or in some religious history, some scholars tend to relate them or attribute them to some separate, discrete traditions or some even foreign influence. While doing that, I want to point out that actually we can understand this exotic, seemingly exotic feature based on the production of knowledge inside an intellectual community. We can just look at the rearrangement of existing knowledge we already have. So now I want to start with the promotion of the status of Confucius in order to show you why they needed a new image of Confucius at the beginning of the first century CE. So Confucius lived from 6th century to 5th century BCE. And by the 3rd century BCE, he was already very famous for being a wise teacher with a very unsuccessful political career. By the 2nd century BCE, he was also considered the author of one of the five Confucian classics, the Annals of Spring and Autumn, and the compiler of the corpus of the five classics in general. By the first century BCE, there was a booming of Confucius' image because during that time, the Han Empire was suffering from overexpansion, and the literati and the emperor were worried that if they kept making their people suffer, heaven will punish them by ending their dynasty and sending its mandate of heaven to somebody else to start a new dynasty. So in order to win heaven's favor back, they needed to change their state policy to something that heaven likes better. So what does heaven like? Basically, they believe that heaven liked the undertaking of the sage kings, because most of them believe that the ancient sage kings understood the will of heaven and the mechanism of heaven, and they designed a government that was based on heaven's will. And where can you find the undertaking of the ancient sage kings? Well, in the five classics Confucius compiled. So Confucius became this person who somehow understood the undertaking of the ancient sage kings, and by extension understood the will of heaven. He became the person who linked the Golden Age to the current Troubled Dynasty. He became this carrier of human civilization. And as his image being promoted, a tension became more and more obvious, which is the tension between Confucius being a sage and Confucius being a loser in his political career. And this tension is more than just a minor issue or a brain teaser. People can doubt by saying that, well, if Confucius could not even overcome the difficulties in his own time to succeed, how could his wisdom and the five classics be so helpful for a dynasty hundreds of years later? So this tension requires reconciliation. And there are several reconciliations since the 2nd century BCE. For example, in Huainanzi, the text argues that it's not that Confucius failed in his career, it's just because he was focused on something else. He was focusing on teaching and writing his book. In the Garden of Persuasion, Shuo Yuan or Shui Yuan by Liu Xiang, Liu Xiang argues that heaven prevented Confucius from obtaining political power. Yang Xiong, in his exemplary speeches, Fa Yan, argued that Confucius' evil contemporaries blocked his way to success. So all these reconciliations make sense in their own system, and some of them are quite reasonable to people for various reasons. For example, Liu Xiang's understanding of heaven is very similar to how Confucius and Mencius understood heaven. They all understood heaven as a troubling and confusing existence, which does things that not easily comprehended by human beings. And for Yang Xiong, this kind of reconciliation is still used in contemporary Chinese textbooks. When a teacher wants to explain why Confucius was such a wise man but failed in his official career, a teacher will say that because his evil contemporaries didn't want him to be successful. But these reconciliations are no longer that appealing to the literati from the first century CE, because they had assumptions that were no longer shared by these reconciliations. So what are these assumptions? One of them is, as I mentioned, Confucius was a great sage. That's how they what they accepted from this booming of Confucius' image. So if you consider Confucius being a great sage, Huainanzi's one and Yang Xiong's one will not be so appealing anymore, because if you consider him being a great sage, you expect him to do some teaching and writing his books while taking some administrative work, like modern professors. For Yang Xiong's one, Yang Xiong's reconciliation will be perfectly reasonable if you consider him as being an ordinary person who is very smart but who is not very lucky. But if you consider him as some kind of cultural hero, you would expect him to fight against his evil contemporaries and clean the world, because isn't that what a superhero is supposed to do? Another assumption the literati had is heaven is not arbitrary. That's most of them believe that heaven punishes evil behaviors and rewards good ones, and that's why they were worried that if they keep making their people suffer, heaven will punish them. In light of this, Liu Xiang's one will not be so appealing anymore, because it sounds like heaven punishes Confucius for being a virtuous man, for being a good person. It sounds like heaven is rather random, and if, especially if you consider heaven being the ultimate source of the human society, then what is the point of bringing Confucius to the world to begin with? And another assumption they have is the five classics reflect heaven's will. This assumption is never mentioned by any of these reconciliations. So basically, that is to say that during that time, the literati needed a new image of Confucius that can not only solve the tension that I mentioned, but also goes along with these assumptions the literati had. And now let's look at how Apocrypha Confucius not only goes along with these assumptions, but somehow even enhances them. First of all, heaven is not arbitrary, and Confucius was not randomly born either. Confucius, according to this Apocrypha passage, Confucius was born specifically to set up something to show the will of heaven. So Confucius was the wooden clapper here. The wooden clapper in early China is kind of a bell used to basically warn people, especially during a fire or during a war. And the wooden clapper is an allusion to a very famous passage from Confucius' Analects, where a person said that the world has been so chaotic, so heaven uses Confucius as its wooden clapper. I guess the original meaning is that heaven uses Confucius as a person who can warn people that, oh, the world has been so corrupted. But we don't really know, based on the original context, that what relationship Confucius and heaven have, and how Confucius would warn people. And here it's very specific. Confucius was born specifically to show heaven's will by setting up something. We'll find out what he will set up. But the wooden clapper is not the only term apocryphal text appropriate from existing texts. They also use other terms relevant to Confucius, such as the uncrowned king. In this passage, it explains that Confucius wrote his annals in spring and autumn in order to set up his way for the upcoming ruler. And his way is called the way of the uncrowned king. In another passage, a passage about Confucius' miraculous conception, where Confucius' mother, whose name is literally the ominous present, was impregnated by the Black Emperor. So Confucius is referred as the Dark Sage. The uncrowned king literally means the plain king, indicating the colors plain on a person's clothes. The translation is adopted from other people, and it has a nice biblical feel. And the Dark Sage sounds like a lousy allusion to some Star Wars movie, but both of the terms are from a Taoist text, Zhuangzi, where Zhuangzi says that if a person have these certain virtues with a position of being a ruler, he will be considered a king. Or in this context, he will be considered a sage king. But if he has these virtues without having a position of being a ruler, he will be considered the dark sage and the plain king. The dark sage indicates somebody in the dark as opposed to in the spotlight. If you take this out of the context a little bit, the uncrowned king actually is quite suitable to describe Confucius' situation, historically speaking. In fact, this term was used by many texts to describe Confucius from the first few centuries CE China. But to my knowledge, the dark sage was never used to refer to Confucius. But this is not before apocryphal texts, I mean. But this is not a big problem because this term is part of a pair with uncrowned king, and they basically mean the same thing, right? But notice, apocryphal text gave a different reason why Confucius was called the Dark Sage. It's not because he was a virtuous person without positions, because his father was the Black Emperor, so he inherited this blackness somehow. That's why he was called the Dark Sage. Well, why do apocryphal texts want to put Confucius into this, you know, this color thing, this black color thing? Because, as you can imagine, they try to put him into the sequence of the five phases. And we have encountered many versions of the five phases. And this is the one that was particularly popular during the first century CE. Basically, we have sequence goals like wood, fire, earth, metal, water, and then it goes back to wood. How it works is that if a dynasty represents, say, wood, then it can only be replaced by a dynasty representing fire, the phase after it. So by this theory, if a person establishes a dynasty, but he doesn't belong to the right order, his dynasty will not be legitimate. And that's why the Qin dynasty is not in the chart, because it's ruled out, as even though it was the first Chinese imperial dynasty. So by the same principle, they try to root out Confucius. Confucius lived under the Zhou dynasty, which represents wood. So if he wants to succeed, he has to represent fire, but he's black, which is water. So he's not in the right order. But you can still ask, why would heaven bring him into this game of the five phases, but doesn't put him in the right order? Well, because apocryphal texts believe that heaven had a very special mission for Confucius. His mission is not to establish a dynasty, but to set up rules. So other sages were ruler type sages, but Confucius is different. Confucius, the master of the rulemaking person, he is the rulemaking type person. And more specifically, Confucius was responsible for passing down the mandate to the upcoming dynasty, upcoming ruler. In this riddle-like passage, the black dragon refers to Confucius, and the red refers to the upcoming dynasty representing fire. And not just passing down the mandate, he was also responsible for setting up a guidance for the upcoming dynasty here, set up rules, and so that the next dynasty can achieve prosperity. I translate the Chinese classical Chinese word fa as rules or standards, because the classical Chinese word contains both meanings, and this guidance and this mandate is not for any dynasty or for any dynasty representing fire. It's very specific. This dynasty is the Han dynasty. It's the current dynasty during that time. And also Confucius put his mandate and guidance together based on historical records and old diagrams. By saying that, apocryphal texts try to link this mandate and guidance to a work attributed to Confucius, which is the Annals of Spring and Autumn. Historically speaking, the Annals was not written by Confucius. It was a chronicle recording the biggest events of the state of Lu from the 8th century to the 5th century. But by the 3rd century, many literati, especially Mencius, argued that Confucius wrote the Annals of Spring and Autumn, or at least he wrote it based on previous historical records in order to criticize his evil contemporaries. Because he was not a king or a ruler, so it was not his position to judge. So he basically hid his criticism and teaching even in between the lines of the Annals. So since then, the Annals became a political teaching. But this political teaching could be for anybody. Apocryphal texts go further than this by inventing a story. The story goes like this. So on the day the mythical animal Qilin was captured, Confucius said to his disciple Zixia that in a month, heaven will send writing in blood at a certain place. And the writing will say, the sage Confucius will die and the Zhou house will perish. So after this certain amount of time, Confucius' disciple Zixia did go to this place to check. And he did find the writing in blood, which says, set up the standard quickly. And then it goes the part that is almost identical to what Confucius told him. The sage Confucius will die, and the Zhou house, and the Zhou dynasty's house of Ji will perish. And then the revelation reveals the rise and fall of the Qin dynasty, which is the dynasty was being ruled out by the five faces we just saw. This is not the weirdest part of the story. One day after, Zixia went back to this place to check again. Suddenly, the writing flew up and became a red crow. The red crow further turned into a white book, in which contains how Confucius should specifically set up the rules. Remember how his disciples said that Confucius never talked about something bizarre or spiritual? This is the opposite. I believe that many people would have difficulties in relating this story to any other stories we know about Confucius, because this is clearly very outlandish, and we don't really find any versions of this story before apocryphal texts either. But I suspect that people from the first century CE can make better sense of this based on a type of stories about Confucius that we are no longer familiar with. I call this type of stories Confucius identifying things. And these stories are scattered around many texts from the first few centuries BCE, such as the standard history, the records of the grand historian Shi Ji by Sima Qian, or by the Garden of Preservation I just mentioned, Liu Xiang's Shuo Yuan, and also some commentary traditions of the five Confucian classics, such as Han Shi Wai Zhuan. In this type of stories, we usually encounter three elements. The first one is a bizarre phenomenon. And then it goes Confucius' explanation of the bizarre phenomenon. And then always a verification of Confucius' explanation. For example, in the story, a person named Ji Huanzi found a goat-like creature in a jar while digging the ground. So he wanted to ask Confucius what is going on, but instead of filling Confucius in, he decided to trick him by telling him that they found a dog while digging the ground. Confucius said, no, you didn't find a dog, you found a goat, because the spirit of earth is not a dog, but a goat. Okay. In another story, similarly, there's some bizarre phenomenon in the state of Wu, and they found a chariot made by huge bones, and they sent some people to ask Confucius what's going on, and Confucius gave an explanation, and the explanation was somehow verified. So in this apocryphal story too, we have the capture of Qi Lin as an omen, and we have Confucius' understanding of this omen, his explanation, and then his explanation is verified by his disciple Zixia. This type of stories is originally aimed to depict Confucius as a sage. By saying a sage, the classical Chinese word sheng has several connotations in early China. One of them is somebody who's knowledgeable, somebody who's keen in hearing and eloquent in talking. So that's why in all these stories, Confucius is always able to identify some rare objects or to explain some rare historical events, or to explain the some weird part of the mechanism of nature. So this apocryphal story also takes advantage of this story. It also tries to tell us that Confucius is knowledgeable, but he's knowledgeable about a very specific topic, which is heaven's will. So in this story, Confucius not only predicts what will happen to him, but also to the dynasty, and he also predicts what will happen to heaven, what heaven will do, and what heaven will say. And of course, what he said is verified by his disciple Zixia. So by making this story, this story actually depicts Confucius as some kind of prophet who can understand heaven's will. And in this story, the annals of spring and autumn also becomes a work that is not just a political teaching written by Confucius, but a heavenly revelation. So Confucius also becomes this prophet who who knows about not what happened in the past, but what will happen in the future. So in responding to the assumption, do the five classics reflect heaven's will? Well, yes, according to this story. One of the five Confucian classics is actually based on the hot, fresh message from heaven. In the apocryphal text, they also try to consolidate this very special relationship between heaven and the Confucius by inventing his miraculous conception. All the other accounts we saw are based on existing texts and other traditions, but they don't really usually go against with the original original sources. But this one actually is an explicit violation of a very famous account about Confucius' conception in the Standard History, where we can clearly identify Confucius' father involved in the conception. So how could the apocryphal text afford such a violation and still appear credible to their audience? Well, first of all, this story is based on a combination. This story is a combination of two stories. One of them is a very famous miraculous conception of the founder of the Han Dynasty, Liu Bang, where we have many similarities, such as the conception in the dream, even for where this story took place, which is the water's edge here. Water's edge is quite generic in terms of semantic meaning, but the combination of words in classical Chinese here, 大泽之杯 or 大泽之坡, is very distinctive. And the other part of the story comes from a miraculous birth of the sage official Yin, where Yin's mother was pregnant with Yin, and a deity just came into her dream and told him that if there's going to be a flood, you just run without looking back. But his mother didn't really follow that that order, so she died after a flood by looking back. Her body turned into a hollow mulberry tree, and this is where people found baby Ian. And secondly, during the first century CE, and even before that time, there's a whole literature about how a founder of a dynasty, or the ancestors of a founder of a dynasty, were usually fatherless. Their mother was either impregnated by stepping on a giant footprint, or by swallowing Job's tears plant, or by just swallowing an egg of a blackbird. So by doing this, apocryphal texts actually try to put Confucius into this universe of the ancient sage kings, and also putting the founder of the Han Dynasty into this universe of the ancient sage kings. They try to tell us that Confucius is just one of these ancient sage kings. He's not so different from them. And they are also very specific about who Confucius' father is, as the black emperor we saw twice. So who's this black emperor? To oversimplify a little bit, the black emperor is one of the emperors of the five faces who represent and embody heaven. So that is to say that Confucius' father was heaven. And now Confucius' weird physical features would make more sense, right? Because if you consider the skies as the physical embodiment of heaven, then looking like the constellations and the moon and the sun would mean that Confucius physically resembles his biological father. And in order to neutralize and downplay this oddness coming from this new image of Confucius, apocryphal texts further tell us that it's not just Confucius. All the other ancient sage kings all have these strange features because they are all the direct descendants of heaven. For example, King Wen of Zhou had double-layered teeth, which I don't think is not that strange among human beings. And Yao had rainbow-like eyebrows, I guess. Diku looked like the moon, and he also looked like the constellation triplet, Shen. The yellow emperor had a dragon-like face, and he also looked like the constellation heavenly court, Tianting. So by linking Confucius to these ancient sage kings and to heaven, apocryphal texts actually are trying to tell us that Confucius is one of them. Confucius is one of the ancient sage kings, and by making these links, they try to respond to the tension I mentioned and to the assumptions we just saw. So why did Confucius really become a ruler or become a high official? Because heaven gave him a very specific mission. This specific mission was just as good as being a ruler, because it's to set up a rule for the new dynasty instead of just setting up a dynasty by himself. They also respond to the three assumptions I mentioned. So is heaven arbitrary? No, heaven is not arbitrary. Heaven actually brought Confucius to the world to help the human society set up its own ruler so that it can achieve prosperity. Was Confucius a great sage? Well, yes, he was a great sage because he was just one of these ancient sage kings, and actually he was also the son of heaven. Do the five Confucian classics reflect the will of heaven? Yes, you bet, because Confucius, as a compiler, knows heaven's will. He can even predict heaven. And one of the five classics is even based on heaven's revelation. This apocryphal Confucius actually has some very interesting implication that we don't usually think about. This is actually the first time in Chinese history where a fate of a dynasty and the legitimacy of a dynasty hinged on a text. In this case, the Annals of Spring and Autumn. And this is also the first time, I think this is the first time in Chinese history where it was well accepted among the literati and the emperors that Confucius was indispensable for a dynasty to set up an ideal rule. But this Confucius is not the Confucius who told us about morality, who was always cranky and grumpy, who was very mean to his students. This is the Confucius who was the dark sage, who was half human, half divine, who is free from any worldly trouble. After the fall of the Han Dynasty, apocryphal Confucius didn't fall with it. You can still find it in various commentary traditions through Imperial China. It's also hiding in one of Confucius' most famous epithets, the ultimate sage, Zhi Sheng, which was originally the dark sage, Xuan Sheng, from the Song Dynasty. And by the end of the 19th century, Wang Kangwei wrote his examinations of Confucius' reform to advocate his versions of a constitutional monarchy. He started his work by lamenting the loss of the ideal rule described by the son of the Black Emperor. Even by the 21st century, when this apocryphal Confucius is already dumped into the trash can of superstitiousness, as political sentiment and the anxiety of legitimacy as a phantom is still haunting the new Chinese dynasty and its emperor. Thank you.